Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers. This is episode number 72, The Born Rule in Gravity. Today I'm going to be talking with Anthony Valentini of Augustus College in London and Clemson University in South Carolina. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/72. Show notes include the papers I read for this podcast, mostly Anthony's papers, other references, which are mostly other people's papers, as well as related episodes of Physics Frontiers and a few other things that I'll mention in the podcast. And now here's my conversation with Anthony Valentini. Hey, Anthony, how's it going?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you. So I just wanted to talk to you about your recent paper, Beyond the Born Rule in Quantum Gravity. I thought this sounded interesting. We've done a couple of discussions that involve the Born Rule, and not quite as many as I'd like to about quantum gravity. And then, you know, I started reading it, and you had an interesting approach that had to do with the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation of quantum mechanics. I found this just really, really interesting, the way it worked out. So I was wondering, could you just tell me, what is the problem you're trying to solve with this approach?
Well, specifically in quantum gravity, there is a sort of cluster of problems that broadly comes under the umbrella term, the problem of time. Essentially, if you apply the usual formalism of quantum mechanics to Einstein's general relativity, instead of ending up with a Schrödinger equation that depends on time, you in effect end up with a time-independent Schrödinger equation for the gravitational field. It's as if the quantum state of the gravitational field appears to be completely static. You know, this became clear in the 1960s with the work of DeWitt and others. And there's a long history of trying to make sense of this. Now, I think it's fair to say that this is still a problem. It's still an issue. Some people think they have a way of solving it, but it's still a live problem, really. Now, that's one side of the paper. There is this ongoing, long problem in quantum gravity, which different people, some people think it's not solved. Some people think they have a solution. There is this problem. On the other side, there is de Broglie-Bohm theory, which is a deterministic non-local theory of motion, which can explain standard quantum mechanics, provided you make an assumption about the initial conditions, that you begin with a distribution of particles or fields that satisfy the Born probability rule. Now, it's interesting to put these things together because there are people who, over two or three decades, actually, who have already been applying de Broglie-Bohm theory to quantum gravity. So you can write down equations in which the gravitational field has a trajectory. It's evolving in time, just like in the ordinary de Broglie-Bohm theory. You have particle trajectories, you have particles moving around. You can write down the equations of a pilot wave theory of quantum gravity, where the pilot wave or wave function still obeys this time-independent Schrödinger equation, if you like. It's usually called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So you've got this timeless static quantum wave, if you like. But you also have a time-evolving gravitational field, which follows a trajectory given by de Broglie's guidance equation, which basically says that the velocity is given by the gradient of the phase of the wave function. That, for instance, for a particle, the velocity of the particle is proportional to the gradient of the phase of the wave function. In the analogous theory of the gravitational field, you can write down an analogous equation. It's in a higher dimensional configuration space, or a point in the configuration space describes the geometry of space, three space. And this point is moving according to a similar equation. Anyway, the problem is, you might think, well, then, you know, you've solved the problem of time. You know, you have motion. Pilot wave theory of quantum gravity, you do have motion. Hopefully there's no problem. But the problem of time in quantum gravity is more complex than that. So one issue that comes up is just how to define probabilities. Part of the problem has always been that, well, if the wave function of the gravitational field is static, then if you apply the usual Born rule, you say, well, probabilities are given by the modulus squared of the wave function. Well, then probabilities don't depend on time, which doesn't seem to make sense. But the problem is actually even worse than that, because when you look at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, it turns out that because of its mathematical structure, the solutions of that equation, in other words, the wave function, cannot be normalized. I mean, there's a mathematical analogy between the Wheeler-DeWitt wave function on configuration space and the usual Klein-Gordon equation on space-time. Now, the Klein-Gordon equation is a wave equation. You have waves propagating in space and evolving in time. And if you try to normalize the Wheeler-DeWitt wave function, it would be analogous to trying to normalize the Klein-Gordon wave function on the whole of space-time, not just over space, but over space-time, which inevitably diverges. You know, so basically in quantum gravity, there's a big mess of problems. Partly the formalism seems to be static, but also you don't have a normalizable wave function, so it seems impossible to define probabilities. So now what has happened in the last 20 or 30 years? There have been some people I would highlight in particular, Nelson Pinto Neto, who's a cosmologist in Rio in Brazil, done a lot of work on applying de Broglie-Bohm theory to quantum cosmology in particular. So you have this static wave function of the universe, but you do have trajectories for the actual, for instance, an expanding universe. You know, the scale factor of the universe can grow, contract, it can evolve. But there is still a problem with defining probabilities, because if you follow the usual route, and you assume that, well, the modulus squared of the wave function, that should be the equilibrium Born rule probability, well, then it's not normalizable. It's not a well-defined probability distribution. So in the pilot wave theory of quantum gravity, you have a strange situation, which is sort of the opposite of textbook quantum mechanics. You have a theory of trajectories, but no theory of probability. So it's all a bit muddled. So there's that, these problems in quantum gravity. You've got these problems even in the pilot wave theory of quantum gravity. And then, you know, to complete the background, if I could just say a bit about work that I've done over the years in de Broglie-Bohm theory, not involving gravity, just on a given background space-time. Normally in this theory, people assume that the Born rule is one of the axioms of the theory. So basically, the usual approach in de Broglie-Bohm quantum mechanics, you say basically I've got three axioms. One is the Schrödinger equation. They've got the usual wave function, but which is now interpreted as a pilot wave that guides the motion of the particles or the fields. Then you've got an equation of motion for the particles or fields, which is given by de Broglie in the 20s, which basically says that the velocity is proportional to the gradient of the phase of the wave function. Okay, so you've got those two postulates, Schrödinger equation, the de Broglie guidance equation, and then most people assume a third postulate, which is that if I have an ensemble of systems with the same wave function, then the initial positions of the particles or the initial field configurations will have an ensemble distribution given by the Born rule. That is usually taken as an axiom. Now, if you do that, it was shown pretty conclusively by Bohm in 1952 that you then recover all of the usual statistical predictions of quantum mechanics. But it's a bit strange because this is a deterministic theory. You've got laws of motion for these particles or fields. And normally in physics, there's a distinction between laws of motion and initial conditions. Laws of motion they're laws, they're immutable. Whereas initial conditions are things that are contingent. They don't have to be this or that. They could be different. There's something you have to go out and measure. when I first started working on this, it didn't look way back 30 years ago. It looked very strange to me. Well, why are you assuming that the initial particles that have this Born rule distribution, that is analogous to saying, imagine in classical mechanics, if I say, well, I've got these laws of motion for my particles, and I'm going to assume that the particles begin in thermal equilibrium. They don't have to begin in thermal equilibrium. They might do. But in classical physics, you can have thermal non-equilibrium. So it looked to me as if what people were doing in de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory is they were, in effect, looking at a very restricted version of the theory, a bit like, you know, restricting classical mechanics to thermal equilibrium. In this theory, you're restricting it to what I call quantum equilibrium. But in principle, just as in classical physics, you could begin with a state that's in thermal non-equilibrium, in this theory, you can begin with a state that's in quantum non-equilibrium, where the Born rule is violated. And if you do that, you get a much richer physics, and you get all kinds of new effects. You get superluminal signaling. It's a non-local theory. When you have entangled particles, you find that there are genuine, at the statistical level, there is genuine non-locality, as in the marginal probability distribution here does depend non-locally on what you do over there. You also get violations of the uncertainty principle. But then you may ask, and here I hope I'm coming to the end of the background, you know, in the lab, in experiments, we always find the Born rule. We always find the equilibrium distribution. Why is that? If you're saying that it's not an axiom and that you can have a richer physics with violations of the usual quantum statistics, why don't we see them? Well, there is a simple explanation that the systems that we see in the lab have all had a long, complicated past history, which actually a long, violent astrophysical history, in fact, that goes back to the Big Bang. Now, you can show in pilot wave theory, and this has by now been studied in lots of examples, in particular numerical simulations have shown, that in this theory, there is something analogous to thermal relaxation. So if you begin with a distribution that is different from the Born rule, with some assumptions, in particular that there's no fine-grained microstructure, you can show that you tend to get an evolution towards the Born rule on a coarse-grained level. And in fact, mathematically, it's quite similar to what happens in classical physics. If I have phase space and I have an initial distribution that is not uniform on the energy surface, then with some assumptions, you know, that distribution will tend to develop fine-grained structure and on a coarse-grained level become uniform on the energy surface. That's how we, you know, in the Gibbs approach to statistical mechanics, that's how we understand thermal relaxation. Something similar happens in pilot wave theory, that the probability distribution develops fine, it's now in configuration space, it develops fine-grained structure, and on a coarse-grained level, it becomes indistinguishable from the modulus squared of the wave function. So the upshot of all that, from my point of view, is that, well, the reason we see the Born rule today is presumably because of some past process of relaxation or quantum relaxation, which, if you think this through, well, then it looks likely, well, this, if this happened, it will have happened in the already in the very early universe. The universe started out in a non-equilibrium state. It would quickly relax to the Born rule. And so, you know, a lot of work has been done on studying quantum relaxation in the very early universe for fields on an expanding space. Well, there's a long story about how if there was early violations of the Born rule, this could be imprinted on the cosmic microwave background. According to inflationary cosmology, the small anisotropies in temperature that we see in the cosmic microwave background ultimately come from the Born rule applied to the inflaton field in the very early universe. And if that Born rule is broken or slightly broken, you would expect anomalies in the CMB. You know, and there are hints of some anomalies at long wavelengths which sort of fit with these ideas. We've also done some work with a couple of cosmologists analyzing CMB data. Some tantalizing hints, but nothing definite. But let me just see if I can quickly summarize, because there are basically three strands to the background to the paper that you've stumbled across. So the first background, which I sort of briefly try to give a sense of, is this long-standing problem in quantum gravity since the 60s. You've got this time-independent quantum state, which is not normalizable. How on earth do we make sense of this? And there's a huge literature on this, and I mean, it's still an ongoing issue. And so that's the first part of the background. The second part of the background is in the last 20, 30 years, some people have been applying de Broglie-Bohm theory to quantum gravity, where now you do have a time-evolving trajectory for the gravitational field or for the curvature of space. But the quantum state psi, the wave functional, is still not normalizable, so you can't really discuss probabilities. And so, in fact, in the papers that have been written, you know, on pilot wave quantum gravity in the last 30 years, they tend to avoid discussing probability. They just look at the trajectories and the properties, but there's no theory of a quantum ensemble. The third part of the background is that looking at pilot wave theory without gravity, there's a long history of people just assuming that the Born rule is an axiom and that the theory is just equivalent to quantum mechanics. And I think that's wrong. I think that this theory is telling us that quantum theory is just a special case of something much bigger, which may have existed in the early universe. There might be some remnants somewhere that we could find. But the reason we see the Born rule today is not because it's an axiom of physics, but simply because it's an equilibrium state that we happen to be in now. And as I said, mathematically, a bit like a thermal equilibrium. Now, that's the background. Now, the paper, you know, is something I've been thinking about, pilot wave quantum gravity, for about 30 years. Well, for a long time, I thought that we had to somehow find an equation for the wave function that was somehow time dependent. And I did some work on that. It never really went anywhere particularly satisfactory. But anyway, I've come up with this idea recently. So several things came together in that paper. So first of all, pondering this question, how to define a Born rule or any kind of probability in quantum gravity that could correspond to what we see in quantum mechanics. How do you do that if the wave function is not normalizable? I mean, it's something I've been playing with for a while. I mean, there's some work I did on black holes quite a long time ago now, where it looked to me as if there might be an argument for saying that quantum gravitational effects could cause the Born rule to become unstable, that an evaporating black hole might radiate particles that are out of equilibrium. But I didn't really have a proper model of this. But anyway, the paper basically picks up on this idea. And the first point, I suppose, in the paper is to rethink this problem, the fact that the wave function is not normalizable. What is it telling us? Instead of trying to fix it somehow. I mean, some people try to somehow, you know, let's see if we can sort of tweak the mathematics and somehow try and make this thing normalizable. It seemed to me now that what it's really telling us is that there is no equilibrium state in quantum gravity. There's already a long history of a certain kind of peculiar behavior involving gravity, even when it comes to thermal equilibrium. I mean, there's a long story behind that. But anyway, one of the claims of the paper is that, look, there is no problem of the normalizability of the Wheeler-DeWitt wave function. All it means is that, look, we have to accept that there is no Born rule. It's a fundamental level of quantum gravity. You cannot have an equilibrium distribution in the usual sense. The probability distribution, which by construction has to be normalized, the probability distribution has to be normalized, can never be equal to to the modulus squared of the wave function. They can never be equal because the modulus squared of the wave function is not a normalizable. And as I said, instead of trying to somehow get around this, let's just bite the bullet and accept that in the deep quantum gravity regime, there's no such thing as the Born rule and there is no quantum equilibrium. But then you might think, well, if that's true, what you can do is you can then write down, because you have the guidance equation, you have these moving trajectories for the gravitational field, I can now discuss the time evolution of a general probability distribution. That's good. But it will never be equal to the Born rule. So that raises a question. Well, hang on a second. If you're saying, for instance, if you think of a Big Bang model of the universe, you would expect that at the earliest times, quantum gravity would be important. Okay, let's say you're close to Planck temperature or something. And so we're saying that in that regime, there simply is no Born rule. The probabilities are different from psi squared, and it has to be. Well, the universe is definitely out of equilibrium at the beginning. And it can't relax to equilibrium. As long as you've got this quantum state that is not normalizable, you can never reach equilibrium. And so this raises the question, well, then how do we explain the fact that we see the Born rule today? You know, if quantum relaxation cannot happen because the wave function is not normalizable, so the probability can never reach psi squared, how do we explain the Born rule today? So there is a way to do that, and it's all quite natural and straightforward. I mean, there is a history of understanding the following, that as you emerge from the deep quantum gravity regime, as quantum gravity effects become small, you expect to recover the standard quantum mechanics and quantum field theory on a background classical space-time. And those particles and fields moving on that background should have a standard time-dependent Schrödinger equation. How to do this? There is a long history of showing how this happens. That basically, you can approximate the Wheeler-DeWitt wave function in such a way that the gravitational field has something like a WKB wave function, where the gravitational field is moving approximately classically, whereas the fields on that background have a general wave function. Now, what happens is, if you assume that you have a sort of approximately classical evolving background for the space-time, then you can define an effective time-dependent wave function for the system on that background. It works like this. The wave function, let's say you've got a field on this background, the wave function to the field implicitly depends on the gravitational field. And if the gravitational field is depending on time, then you can write down an effective time-dependent wave function for the field and extract something that looks like a time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Now, this is pretty standard stuff in the literature. What is obscure in the quantum gravity literature is, well, how do you get this evolving approximately classical background for the gravitational field? Because fundamentally, the theory is static. There's nothing moving. And there's always been a bit of hand-waving about that. People appeal to the classical limit and blah, blah, blah. In de Broglie-Bohm theory, it's all clear. Because there is an underlying motion, this sort of derivation of what's called the semi-classical approximation. Okay, I begin deep quantum gravity regime, everything is static. The semi-classical approximation, I somehow end up with a time-dependent wave function for particles and fields on a classical space-time. The way that approximation is derived can be made precise in pilot wave theory because you do have underlying motions. So if I have a static wave function that depends on the geometry of space, if that geometry is moving in time, then I can interpret this wave function as an effectively time-dependent wave function. Anyway, so what I'm saying is if you go through the usual semi-classical approximation to derive an approximately time-dependent wave function for a standard system on a background, you can do that clearly in pilot wave theory. And so as you emerge from the deep quantum gravity regime, well, now I'm going to have the standard theory with time-dependent wave functions on a classical space-time background. And then the process that I discussed, this quantum relaxation process, can then begin. Because I now have time-dependent, normalizable wave functions for my particles and fields. And so I will get the usual quantum relaxation. And we will end up with the Born rule for subsystems that we see today. You know, so if I can just summarize that, so thinking this through, it looks as if, well, in the deep quantum gravity regime, there's no Born rule, you can never reach equilibrium. As you emerge into a semi-classical approximation, where you have an approximately classical space-time with quantum particles and fields propagating on it, in that approximation, you then arrive at the usual time-dependent normalizable wave functions, and you then get the usual quantum relaxation to the Born rule, which has been discussed in detail. So you still get the Born rule as you emerge from the deep quantum gravity regime, even though fundamentally in this theory, there's no Born rule and it's not even possible to have quantum equilibrium. So that's two aspects of the, there are really three aspects of the paper. The first aspect is deep quantum gravity regime, there's no such thing as quantum equilibrium, cannot exist. The second aspect is in the semi-classical regime, you recover the usual time-dependent wave functions, and then you can get quantum relaxation. So what this means is, maybe this will be a good point to, you know, you asked me about implications. There's a long controversy in pilot wave theory between people who think that the Born rule should just be an axiom. In other words, the equilibrium theory is the theory. In fact, that is most people in the field, even though actually Boehm in his original papers didn't really think that way. But soon afterwards, this became the standard view, that you've got the Schrödinger equation, the guidance equation, the Born rule, and that's the theory. For the past 30 years, I've been arguing that this is a mistake, and that really, if you take this theory seriously, it's telling you that there's a wider non-equilibrium physics where the Born rule is violated, and the logical place to look for that would be in the early universe. Now, some people say, you know, in answer to that, in effect, they say, well, isn't it just simpler to just assume that you have the Born rule at the beginning of the universe, and that's that? There's no need for this quantum relaxation. You're never going to see any anomalous violations of quantum mechanics. Why mess about like this with the Born rule? According to the work I've done in this latest paper, that view is actually not tenable. To suggest that, well, we could just take the Born rule as an axiom at the beginning of time is actually not possible, even if you wanted to, because at the beginning of time, if you're in the deep quantum gravity regime, you cannot define a Born rule. The wave functional is not normalizable. There can be no Born rule. There can be no quantum equilibrium. So you have to begin out of equilibrium. And then the only way to explain the emergence of the Born rule later on will be through some process of quantum relaxation, as I've described in the semi-classical regime. So in a nutshell, you know, I would say that this work in pilot wave quantum gravity vindicates the idea that I've been pushing for 30 years, that if you take this theory seriously, then the universe should have begun in a non-equilibrium state where the Born rule is violated. And it's only with evolution over time that you get relaxation to the Born rule and the quantum mechanics that we see. So that's that. And then finally, there's a third point in the paper, which I think is a bit more speculative. I mean, it seems to me that the first two points, if you take the Wheeler-DeWitt equation seriously, and if you take the Breuer-Bohm theory seriously, then I think there's a very strong argument there that, look, deep quantum gravity regime, you can't have equilibrium. That's one point. The only way that you will get the Born rule is through a process of quantum relaxation. I think those two points are very strong. There's a third point, which is a bit, well, let's say less strong, but still, I think, interesting and perhaps true, is that when you perform that semi-classical approximation to derive an effective time-dependent Schrödinger equation on the background, to a first approximation, you find the usual Schrödinger equation, for example, for a standard scalar field on the background space-time. But there are corrections to that approximation that come from, you know, the underlying quantum gravitational equations. There are small corrections that depend on the Planck mass and that are very small. And in effect, what you find is when you derive your Schrödinger equation for the time-dependent wave function, to a first approximation, you find the usual Hamiltonian for the field. But then there are small corrections to the Hamiltonian. You know, that's expected, you know, that there will be small quantum gravitational corrections to the Schrödinger equation. What is perhaps unexpected, and this was first found in 1991 by Kiefer and Singh, is that when you look at the small corrections to the Hamiltonian, some of them are Hermitian, you know, as usually expected, but some of them are non-Hermitian. And it's very hard to make sense of that in standard quantum mechanics. Now, you know, similar results have been rederived over the years in quantum cosmological models. You get these quantum gravitational corrections to the Schrödinger equation. You find that some of the terms are non-Hermitian. There's a natural response to that. You know, if in standard quantum mechanics, you would think that, well, look, these terms, they must be some sort of artifact. They can't be real. There must be something wrong with the approximation. There's something not quite right. And in fact, there is a history of people just ignoring these terms or perhaps redefining the wave function in some way to eliminate the terms or perhaps by developing the semi-classical approximation in a different way to avoid these terms. And maybe that's right. Maybe these terms are artifacts. And certainly in standard quantum mechanics, you would think, well, they had better be artifacts and, you know, we should try and get rid of them. It's a different story if you look at it from the point of view of pilot wave theory, because in pilot wave theory, by construction, my particles or fields are moving according to definite velocity law. And if I look at an ensemble, I can evolve the probability distribution, which by construction will remain normalized. I mean, it's just by construction. There's no problem with the time evolution of probability. Whereas in standard quantum mechanics, if I assume that the probability is density is given by mod psi squared, in the presence of non-Hermitian terms, if mod psi squared is initially normalized, later the norm will change. You will not have conservation of probability. But now what happens in pilot wave theory? If I say, hang on, no, I've got my density, which is evolving, and it's a consistent, well-defined probability evolving in time. What happens in the presence of the non-Hermitian terms is that if at the initial time the probability density happens to be equal to mod psi squared, we're in equilibrium, we've got the Born rule, in the presence of the non-Hermitian terms, if I evolve forward in time, the probability density will evolve away from the Born rule. So in other words, if I begin in equilibrium, I can evolve out of equilibrium. Now, these effects are very small. The terms are very small and the effects are very small. But it's an intriguing possibility. If the non-Hermitian terms are genuine physical corrections in Hamiltonian, in pilot wave theory, I can interpret them consistently, and the upshot of the implication of those terms is that the Born rule can become slightly unstable. Now, from the point of view of pilot wave theory, you know, this adds an interesting element to the theory, because if you look at pilot wave theory just on a classical space-time background, so there's no quantum gravity, you can have quantum non-equilibrium and violations of quantum mechanics. And from the work that's been done, it looks very likely that in the violence of the early universe, you're quickly going to get relaxation to the Born rule. And it's going to be very hard to find any traces of this non-quantum physics or sub-quantum physics. Maybe there's some anomalies in the CMB. Maybe there's some relic particles from the very early universe that didn't reach the Born rule. I mean, there are possibilities, but it's difficult. Here we are 14 billion years later. Everything that we see around us has long ago relaxed to the Born rule. You go in the lab, you start doing experiments with hydrogen atoms. They reach quantum equilibrium probably, you know, billions of years ago. And once you're in that state, it's a little bit like there's actually quite a good analogy with the classical heat death of the universe, which some people worried about in the 19th century. You know, as people's understanding of thermodynamics developed, people realized, well, hang on, just on thermodynamic grounds, even though we don't really understand, you know, what is powering the sun and the stars and so on, we eventually everything's going to have to, things will burn out. Temperatures will equalize. Eventually, we will reach a state of global thermal equilibrium. And when that happens, remember that in thermodynamics, you can only convert heat into work or into useful work if you have differences of temperature. You can set up a heat flow and extract useful work from it. But without differences of temperature, you reach what was called the heat death of the universe. And it was given that name because, well, it means that the universe is, in a sense, dead. There's nothing much that can happen anymore, barring extremely rare fluctuations, which one might speculate about. But anyway, according to pilot wave theory, if you accept this idea that, well, you could begin, the early universe was out of equilibrium, and then the Born rule was reached by a process of quantum relaxation. It's very analogous to the state of classical heat death. In fact, these days I tend to call it the quantum death. Once you're in that state, a lot of the underlying physics is hidden. So, for instance, in the classical heat death, if I have differences of temperature, I can convert heat into work. But when you're in the heat death state, you can no longer do that. You've got this huge reservoir of thermal energy that you can't do anything with. In the quantum case, remember, pilot wave theory is non-local. Entangled particles affect each other instantaneously. It turns out that when you're in the equilibrium state, where all systems obey the Born rule, you can no longer use entanglement for superluminal signal. So the non-locality is there, but you can't actually use it. In pilot wave theory, if you're in a general non-equilibrium state, you can use entanglement for superluminal signal. It's only when you're in equilibrium and you have the uncertainty principle and the Born rule that the underlying non-locality, in effect, you could say it sort of averages out to zero. The marginal distribution here no longer depends on what someone does over there. So once you're in this state of quantum death, you can't see the trajectories clearly because of the uncertainty principle and the sort of quantum noise, if you like, that's associated with the Born rule. You can't use entanglement for signaling, and you're basically stuck in a state where much of the underlying physics is forever inaccessible, and you have, in effect, quantum mechanics as an effective theory, and the deeper physics is forever inaccessible and can, in a sense, never be tested. You can never really confirm that these trajectories really exist because of the uncertainty principle. So, you know, if pilot wave theory is true, if this scenario is true, that you start out in the early universe with non-equilibrium, but then things relax and you end up in this state of quantum death, if that state is permanent, if it's going to be, you know, like the classical heat death of the universe, once you're there, you're stuck there forever, then it's something of a scientific nightmare because you know, if you're unable to find any traces of the early non-equilibrium at the beginning of the universe, you know, it could be that for the rest of human history, you're stuck in this state that you can never get out of. But now, if it's true that if there really are these small non-Hermitian terms in the Hamiltonian coming from quantum gravitational corrections to the Schrödinger equation, then at some level, there will be a small instability of the Born rule, that this equilibrium state is not necessarily permanent. You can evolve away. Once you're there, you can still get out of it. Now, for these effects to be significant, before we get too excited, you have to be in a situation where quantum gravitational effects are not too small. They have to be significant. Now, one of the possibilities I discuss in the paper, which seems to me at the moment perhaps the most promising, or at least the least difficult to perhaps realize in practice, would be in the presence of an evaporating black hole. Now, Kiefer and collaborators had already pointed out in the 90s that close to a black hole, there should be a small non-Hermitian term, you know, coming from their approximation. But at the time, it's not really clear, well, how could you interpret that in quantum mechanics? You get violations of the conservation of probability. And they'd suggested that maybe this had something to do with black hole information loss. But it wasn't very clear what to do with this term. As I said, in pilot wave theory, such a term, what it does, it makes an initial Born rule distribution evolve away from the Born rule. So if such a term existed close to an evaporating black hole, it would mean that the fields around the black hole would evolve away from the Born rule. So you would expect the way a black hole evaporates is that the quantum fields in space, you have some ingoing and outgoing modes. If you do a sort of Fourier expansion of the quantum field, you have modes that are falling into the hole and modes that are coming out of the hole. And these modes are entangled. And it's the outgoing modes that we see as Hawking radiation. Now, if you had this non-Hermitian term present in the Hamiltonian for those fields, you would expect those fields to evolve slightly away from the Born rule. And the upshot of that would be that Hawking radiation, the, let's say, photons coming out, if you look at the photons in Hawking radiation, you could reasonably expect that at some level, the precision, those photons could violate the Born rule because they've moved away from quantum equilibrium because of this non-Hermitian term. Now, precise calculations of this haven't been done yet. There is sort of some simple estimates of the time scale, which is given in that paper. And it looks as if the effect will only be important in the very final stages when the black hole has evaporated so far down that it's approaching the Planck mass. So it looks as if the effect would be significant only in the very final burst as the black hole explodes, only the very final burst of radiation, potentially, if those photons, if they were coming towards us, and for instance, we pass them through a two-slit experiment, the interference pattern of the backstop could be anomalous. Instead of getting the usual Born rule psi-squared distribution, you could get something different that violates the Born rule. Unfortunately, it's a bit too early to say because we don't have a precise enough study of these effects, but it is looking like it's going to be quite a tall order to, well, let me say first of all, that finding radiation from an exploding black hole is already something that we can't do yet, but which we might do soon. There are satellites in space, for example, that are searching for anomalous X-ray, gamma-ray pulses from various parts of the galaxy, other galaxies, which could be, there's a long-standing scenario where in the very early universe, small black holes formed, called primordial black holes, that could have formed in the very early universe. This was originally theorized by Stephen Hawking and others. And there are some well-developed scenarios according to which there could well be a large population of primordial black holes scattered throughout the universe, and they could be a significant component of dark matter. Now, these primordial black holes, some of them could be expected to be exploding around now. Because they're small, the lifetime for the Hawking evaporation process is comparable to the current age of the universe. Some people, there have even been claims of literature that maybe they've seen already certain X-ray or gamma ray flashes that could be exploding primordial black holes. There's nothing definite yet. But anyway, what I want to say is things like the Fermi satellite tomorrow might detect radiation from exploding primordial black holes. And according to these ideas, it would be good to test those photons to see, do they really obey the Born rule? Do they follow the usual rules of quantum mechanics? Or are there some anomalies? A difficulty for this scenario, if it's true, is that, as I said, it looks as if the effects will only be significant in the very final burst, which means that only a tiny fraction of the photons that are radiated are likely to have a significant deviation from the Born rule. So whether it's going to be realistic to actually detect anything, I'm not sure. But still, I think just on general grounds anyway, as in fact I theorized by a different argument a long time ago, it seems plausible that Hawking radiation could be out of quantum equilibrium, also as a way of avoiding the black hole information loss paradox. So basically, you know, in a nutshell, you're going off into something else a bit different now, but in a nutshell, Hawking radiation is essentially thermal, and it seems not to contain any record of exactly what fell into the black hole. And this, many people regard this as paradoxical. If you accept the possibility that Hawking radiation could be in a state of quantum non-equilibrium where the particles violate the Born rule, then it could carry a lot more information than conventional quantum mechanical Hawking radiation. So there's a possible route there for avoiding the black hole information loss problem. So I think just on those grounds alone, even apart from everything else we've been discussing, I think there's a case for saying that, look, if we do find Hawking radiation from exploding primordial black holes, let's test those photons to see if they obey the Born rule. And in fact, people are now talking about quantum experiments in space. This is something that people have become interested in, just testing quantum mechanics in space and entanglement, for instance, between photons on a satellite in space and photons on the ground. So it does look as if imminently we would be in a position where we would have a satellite in space that can perform quantum mechanical experiments with photons, such as even something simple like a two-slit experiment, or testing polarization probabilities or something like that. If we then say, hang on, if we found photons coming from exploding primordial black holes from the center of the galaxy or something, let's then, you know, let these photons come in to the satellite, into this experiment and test. It seems that that experiment could plausibly be done in the next few years. Of course, there would be a much bigger motivation if we do, in fact, find radiation from exploding primordial black holes, which we haven't yet, or at least it's not been confirmed. So, and I think that's about the state of play at the moment.
Excellent, excellent. So I guess I didn't ask you a lot of questions, or like any.
I went on a long ramble. You got me going. You didn't interrupt me, so.
I'm sorry. I guess, right. Let's see. So let's start backwards with some questions. Sort of interested in, you know, you're talking about these effects and, you know, you're seeing some change in what you see on an interference pattern, let's say. But you're still going to have the non-permission terms, even if you're not thinking about this in terms of the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation.
Oh, yes. Okay. Okay, right. Okay. So what you're saying is if I'm just doing standard quantum mechanics, you know, and if I believe this, the way the semi-classical approximation is derived from quantum gravity, what do we do with these non-Hermitian terms? That's a very good question. You know, I mean, I know, you know, Klaus Kiefer, you know, he's a quantum gravity theorist. And I mean, he together with Tejinder Singh, they first discovered these terms in 1991. I understand from Klaus Kiefer that, well, the impression I have is that he's maybe vacillated a bit. Aren't these terms really physical? Are they telling us perhaps something about, I don't know, non-unitarity, black hole information loss, or should we somehow just get rid of them by redefining the wave function? Or I think he's unsure. He suspects that it might be physically real, but it's just difficult to make sense of in standard quantum mechanics because, you know, you get total probability is no longer conserved. There is, you know, one way of thinking about black hole information loss is that it looks as if a pure state, a pure quantum state can evolve into a mixed quantum state. So the argument is if I imagine I start out with some matter that's in a pure quantum state and it undergoes gravitational collapse to a black hole. If the black hole completely evaporates, it seems that I'm left with thermal radiation that's in a mixed state. So we seem to have a process whereby I can have an isolated system that evolves from a pure quantum state to a mixed quantum state, which, you know, violates the basic rules of quantum mechanics. You know, there was a paper by Kiefer and collaborators in the 90s where they were trying to somehow relate these non-Hermitian terms to perhaps this problem. And it wasn't really quite clear to me how this could work, but you know, one can imagine, you know, the temptation. It looks as if, well, maybe this has something to do with it. But I should mention, I mean, there are, you know, some people will say, look, I just don't believe these Hermitian terms are really there. There's something wrong with this approximation. You know, no doubt to lowest order, you've derived the time-dependent Schrödinger equation for this quantum field on the background. That's fine. But then when you go to calculating these higher order corrections, there must be something wrong or there must be a better way of doing this. In fact, some people think that the calculations are just not really being done properly. And of course, from a point of view of standard quantum mechanics, that would be, there's a strong argument for that. These terms just shouldn't be there. There must be another way of deriving these corrections where you avoid such non-Hermitian terms. It just so happens that, well, in pilot wave theory, this argument is not so strong. There's no particular reason why you couldn't have small non-Hermitian terms. It would just make the Born rule slightly unstable. That's perfectly consistent with pilot wave theory. So let's put it this way. From the point of view of pilot wave theory, I would say it's plausible that the terms are really there. From the point of view of standard quantum mechanics, it looks more likely that, well, we must have done something wrong. And it seems to me that probably at the end of the day, maybe the question can only be decided empirically. You know, if you think of it like this, imagine you've got this big wave function of the universe that's static, and we're living inside this thing. And, you know, we experiment with approximate time-dependent little wave functions for subsystems. And somehow those effective wave functions need to be derived mathematically from the structure in this big static thing. How do we do that? Well, there are different ways of doing this. Some give non-Hermitian terms. Now, if we ask, well, how are we going to know which is the correct way to do this? How do I extract the effective wave functions that we see from this underlying big static wave function? It seems to me that maybe at the end of the day, we'll need some sort of empirical, there's an empirical element here. I mean, there will be different ways of defining effective wave functions. How do we know what is the correct way? It might be that the only way to be sure is we're going to have to go out in the world and make measurements and, you know, find out, are there non-Hermitian terms? Is there a small instability of the Born rule?
My feeling is that probably that may be the only way to really settle the question of whether these non-emission terms really exist or not. At least that's how it looks to me at the moment.
It seems to me that if you're looking at something like the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, if you're looking at something where the wave function is a real thing in some way, which is what's going on here, then you don't have the big problem of interpreting this. And this was a big problem trying to read the paper, is, you know, trying to think, okay, so how do I interpret psi if I don't have a Born rule? Obviously, if I'm looking at it where this is an actual physical field, I no longer necessarily need that idea that, you know, psi star psi is my probability.
Yes, no, exactly. No, exactly. It can happen that in equilibrium, probabilities happen to coincide with the magnitude squared of the wave. But in general, the wave is a physical thing. I mean, it's a strange physical thing. It exists on configuration space, but it's pushing the particles around. And yes, that's right. You know, you're not tied to the Born rule in this theory. Which brings me back to this controversy. I mean, it's always seemed to me very odd. You know, it seems obvious to me that in pilot wave theory, the Born rule is not a law, an axiom. It's, you know, it's an equilibrium state. Just as in classical physics, you know, you don't have to have thermal equilibrium. And it would be silly if we said, you know, in our textbooks on classical physics, all they ever discussed, you know, you've got Newton's three laws of motion plus the axiom of thermal equilibrium. And that would be odd. And it seems to me that that is what people have been doing in pilot wave theory since the 50s. Interestingly enough, in Bohm's original papers, 1952 and then in 1953, he considered ideas similar to this that can see in his papers, that he sees that the Born rule is an initial condition that could probably be explained by something analogous to thermal relaxation. And he made a study of this in a paper in 1953. But then it's very unfortunate. I mean, he was very close to, you know, to doing, you know, he was basically beginning to do, you know, what I've been doing the last 30 years. But then in 1954, in a paper with Vigier, they argued that, well, you know, there are problems with proving that you get quantum relaxation to the Born rule. So let's modify the theory. What they did is they took the deterministic theory and they added what they called sort of subquantum fluid fluctuations. They turned it into a stochastic theory where the particle trajectories are subject to random disturbances in such a way that you would get the Born rule. And, it, you know, looking back at this, I mean, it was all so unnecessary. You know, I mean, we know now you can get quantum relaxation just from the deterministic theories. But unfortunately, once that step was taken after that, I mean, since the 50s and the 60s, you know, most papers on this theory, and then there's some textbooks now. I mean, Peter Holland in 1993 has a textbook, you know, The Quantum Theory of Motion. It's basically an undergraduate textbook on quantum mechanics, all done in terms of de Broglie-Bohm theory. It's published with Cambridge, 1993. It's a nice book. You know, if you want to know exactly how tunneling works or what the hydrogen atom looks like, you know, it's all in there. But he does take the approach that the Born rule is one of the axioms of the theory. So it's always equivalent to quantum mechanics. And as I said, you know, to me, that doesn't make physical sense. You know, the laws of motion can be axioms. I've got the Schrödinger equation. I've got the equation for the trajectories. These are laws. The initial condition, I mean, the Born rule is an initial condition. That can't be a law. That's something which might be true, might not be true. We have to go out and measure and see if it's true. But somehow in the literature, in fact, there is a sort of subgroup, if you like, or school of de Broglie-Bohm theory. They tend to call the theory Bohmian mechanics. And it goes back to a paper published in 1992 by Dürr, Goldstein, and Zanghi, where basically they argue that the Born rule should be taken to be a fundamental measure for the initial conditions of the universe. In other words, you know, when you think about the initial conditions of the universe, in effect, you assume that the Born rule is true initially. They discuss it in terms of what they call typicality, a measure of typicality on the initial conditions of the universe. And they assume that the Born rule is that measure. Now, you know, in effect, they assume the Born rule for the initial conditions of the universe, but they try to argue that this is somehow fundamental, that it has to be that way. And with that axiom or hypothesis, then, you know, the Born rule follows for subsystems. You always have the Born rule right from the initial time, always. And there's been a long dispute between myself and that group. You know, it's always seemed to me that this argument is, well, it's essentially circular. You're assuming the Born rule at the beginning of the universe for the whole universe to derive the Born rule for subsystems. Now, this new work changes the discussion significantly because the idea that you could just postulate the fundamental Born rule measure at the beginning of the universe actually is not even possible if you're in the quantum gravity regime, because the wave function of the universe does not give you a well-defined probability measure. So, you know, from that point of view, I think if this work, you know, leaving aside all this non-emission issue, which is a bit more speculative, just on the point about the status of the Born rule in pilot wave quantum gravity, I think there's a very strong argument there that you have to say that, look, at the beginning of time, there can be no Born rule. There can be no equilibrium state. You can only get the Born rule later on by some sort of relaxation process. And has that left any traces that we can see today? Possibly. I mean, that's something I've worked on a lot over the last couple of decades. There are some various possibilities. Sorry, I forgot where we were now. I can't remember what question I was supposed to be answering. But.
Well, I had just been speculating that for the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, where you have a physical wave function, really for any psi-ontic theory with a physical wave function, that not being able to define psi as a probability measure is perfectly fine. If you had a psi-epistemic theory, on the other hand, if you had a theory where the wave function describes a state of knowledge of the observer, then if you have a situation where you can't normalize the wave function and get a good probability distribution through the Born rule, then that interpretation goes away. It's just impossible. And that's a huge class of interpretations of quantum theory. And those are the ones that I think most people subscribe to.
Yes, well, that's right. And this is why, of course, you know, this problem of time and generally the problem of probability in quantum gravity has been going on for, you know, well over half a century. Because most people, you know, they're thinking in terms of standard quantum mechanics. And how to recover something like conventional time-dependent probabilities. There's a whole series of proposals. You know, for instance, there's a long history of people saying that we somehow have to define conditional probabilities. But, you know, it's just very hard to do that when everything is static. You know, to get something that depends on time. Some people propose that, you know, in the conventional static timeless theory, we have to interpret some of the degrees of freedom as playing the role of time. So, you know, popular choice, for instance, in quantum cosmology is you say, well, let's take the size of the universe to be our time parameter. So I've got this wave function. There's no time in there, but it's a function of the size of the universe. It's a function of whatever fields are in the universe. Maybe if I treat the size of the universe as time, I can recover something that looks like an effectively time-dependent wave function and get back to something that looks like quantum mechanics. And there's a long history of this. You know, and sometimes it has a limited success, but then you get problems. You know, for instance, what happens if I have a universe that expands and then starts to recontract? You know, does this mean that that time stops and then starts going backwards again? In fact, Hawking in the 80s suggested that actually, you know, on the basis of these kinds of arguments, he suggested that actually if the universe was closed, and it expanded to a maximum size and started to recontract, he suggested that the arrow of time would start going backwards again because of it turned out that there were problems with this. So there's a long history of trying to make sense of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in quantum gravity in standard quantum mechanics, but it's still a very murky subject. You know, as I said, even leaving aside anything non-Hermitian. For instance, if you try to perform the semi-classical approximation, just at lowest order, you just want to derive a standard time-dependent Schrödinger equation for some particles that are moving in a classical background space-time. How do I get that time-dependent Schrödinger equation from the fundamental equations? The way that's usually done, as I mentioned, there's a hand-waving, you know, if you assume that somehow the classical space-time background is evolving in time, as we expect classically, then you can define this effective time-dependent wave function for the quantum system. But it's never been clear how that happens in standard quantum mechanics. It's as if really they're inserting these classical trajectories by hand. Whereas in de Broglie-Bohm theory, it's quite clear. The de Broglie-Bohm trajectory for the gravitational field is doing the work. You know, you don't have to put anything in by hand. I mean, it does look to me as if, you know, already just in standard quantum mechanics with the measurement problem and the lack of a clear sense of what is real, you're in a very murky territory. In quantum gravity, with this timeless formalism, you're in very murky territory because nothing seems to be happening. You put the two together. You know, standard quantum gravity with standard quantum mechanics, I mean, it's extremely difficult to say anything sensible, but people try and they're still at it. I mean, I should mention that there are people who think that really that there isn't a problem here, that our intuitions about time and our expectations of how quantum mechanics should come out in a certain approximation, that those expectations will only be met in very limited circumstances. And that, you know, something like, for instance, if I ask, well, what happens if a universe expands and recontracts? What happens to time? We'll say, well, you know, that's not our universe. The universe is eternally expanding, and so we don't need to worry about this. So I guess there isn't even agreement about whether the problem of time really is a problem. A lot of people think it's a problem. Other people think that somehow it's a non-problem. I think it's a problem.
I mean, obviously, a lot of people agree with you. One of your references was to another Keeper paper, right? Which is right here, Time and Quantum Cosmology. You had a reference to a huge book. I didn't realize it was too huge until...
Ah, yes, the book by Anderson. That's it, Edward Anderson. So it came out, 2017? I mean, it's a massive book. It's nearly 1,000 pages. I mean, it's a very thorough study of all the different approaches to the problem of time. It's a massive, I mean, he goes through all the literature since the 60s and all the different proposals and the problems and you know, each of the advantages and disadvantages. And you know, you look at that book and you think, well, it's still an ongoing problem. I mean, I don't think we're 1967, 70, you know, over 50 years later, people are still writing a 1,000-page book about this problem, and you know, presumably it hasn't been solved yet. But yes, and Kiefer and Patrick Peter, yes, they published recently a review of the problem of time in quantum gravity. That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing issue.
Well, I would love to keep asking you questions, but I think we've been talking for a very long time, and I think if I ask any more questions, we'll talk for much, much longer.
Yes.
You did in one of your emails say, if we talk about the problem of time, we'll probably talk about it for the next 3 weeks.
Yes. You can go on forever. No, yes, that's right. I mean, it's such a multifaceted problem as well. You know, with so many proposals for a solution that people got excited about, and they find there's a problem, and then it gets rediscovered 20 years later. I mean, it's fine anyway.
Well, so I think this was really informative. I really enjoyed talking with you here. It was very interesting.
Thank you.
I guess you talked about this in 2018 at The Perimeter Institute, was that correct?
Yes. Oh, yes. There was. I gave a talk in, that's right, I think it was February when I was still in Clemson. And that was sort of early version. There was still a lot I hadn't understood, but yes. I mean, basically, you know, the key ideas were there.
I'll also put a link in the show notes for that because it's on.
Oh, okay.
You know, since we were delayed a little bit, I was just watching it.
So I remember the title there was, I think the title there was, Is the Born Rule Unstable in Quantum Gravity? So, you know, I think, if I remember rightly at that time, so, I mean, for a long time, I've been suggesting that there would be no equilibrium state in quantum gravity. But the non-Hermitian terms, that's it. There was something, one reason I wasn't sure. In order to show this instability of the Born rule, you need to derive the actual de Broglie guidance equation in this same approximation. And I hadn't done that yet, so I wasn't quite sure. But anyway, but there was something that was done, you know, managed to do in the last 2 or 3 years and show that, you know, if you start with quantum gravity, you derive the semi-classical approximation, and then you derive corrections to the Schrödinger equation. If you look at the actual corrections to the de Broglie velocity field, you find that basically the de Broglie velocity field remains the same as you would expect. The wave function guides the system in the same way as even without the corrections. And once you've established that, then you can show for certain that the Born rule will be unstable. But that's something I worked out more recently. But anyway, but the basic points are there in that talk at Perimeter. But there's also, I may say, actually, there's a talk I gave as I was completing this work. So in 2021, there was a conference, an online conference called Quantum Limits of Knowledge. And I gave a talk on, as I was completing, so before the paper that you saw, there's a big paper I put on the archive, which is way too long. I mean, but anyway, yeah,
I was just about to ask about that one, the 94-page paper.
Yeah, that massive paper where I was sort of working all this stuff out and finishing it. You know, as I was completing that, I gave a talk, which is actually the better talk. It's a complete talk. Everything is there. And it's the Quantum Limits of Knowledge Conference 2021. And it's on YouTube. They put it all on YouTube. It's about, I think, a 45, 50-minute talk.
I'll look for that one as well.
That talk is based on the full set of ideas are all there, properly explained. The one at Perimeter, as I said, was sort of preliminary. I hadn't quite figured everything out yet, so.
I'll make sure everybody has access to those and can find them relatively easy for you.
You know, I might mention, actually, I remember I sent you something I wrote in Physics World for general background on this stuff, 2009. I don't know if you found it useful. But there is actually a version on the archive in the same year. If you go on archive, I think it's the same title, Beyond the Quantum. It's basically, yeah, I put that article on the archive.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you could, if you want, provide a link to that. If you want sort of general background reading about these ideas of non-equilibrium and all this. Also a bit of the history of de Broglie, what de Broglie really did. Because a lot of people still don't know that the full theory was put forward by de Broglie in 1927. I mean, Bohm revived it in 1952, but the whole theory was really there already in 1927.
I will do that. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Tim. All the best. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Had a great time.
Bye-bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers episode number 72, The Born Rule and Gravity, with Anthony Valentini. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/72. And these show notes include Anthony's papers, some other reference papers, related episodes of Physics Frontiers, and as you heard, a few videos of Anthony's lectures. Thank you very much for listening. Bye now.